Our guest today is one of the most renowned, most respected foreign affairs journalists in India. She's known for breaking down some of the most complex stories simply and meaningfully. Diplomatic editor at The Hindu, Suhasini Haider. Welcome to RT.
Thanks so much, Ranjan, and thank you for this very warm welcome I'm getting from Pari here.
Well, we're glad you're here, Suhasini. My first question to you would be, how do you read US President Donald Trump's latest announcement on Iran? He says it's a pause for 5 days for talks, but Iran says that there are no talks.
Well, I think one can look at it many ways, and I'm sure it's being analyzed by governments and capitals around the world. But at the end of the day, beyond what, the obvious things, is there talks going on or not? Are there talks with a specific part of Iran and not of another? Who are the interlocutors? Which countries are now playing a role? These are all the modalities of the talks. But the broader message, I would say, from what Trump is saying over here is that the first 3 weeks of the war have not gone as planned.
Trump did not use the word ceasefire. He did not use the word peace. All he's saying is that this is a pause, which means that basically the bombs are ready, but America is not just dropping them today. Do you think this is really about cooling off the energy prices?
The fact that he says that there is a pause is a way of saying, I am not going to bomb on deadline. I.e. putting off or buying time when he had said very clearly 48 hours, open the Hormuz Straits or face a bombardment of your energy facilities. So he's saying, I don't have to bomb right now. He's buying time for whatever the U.S. eventual purpose is. But one must again ask that basic question, where is this going to lead to next? And secondly, if the U.S. has now put this pause, can they go back? Can they go back to a full bombardment of Iran without finding a new way out? Somebody wisely said that the definition of madness is to keep doing the same thing and expecting a different result. If in 3 weeks of bombardment, you have been able to decimate some part of the Iranian leadership, but not change the kind of Iranian behavior, if you like, then are you going to succeed in a few more weeks of that? That's certainly, it's possible that that's how the U.S. strategic thinkers are going.
Do you think Iran's strategy was partly to weaken the U.S. economically, keeping the oil markets unstable, keeping the threat of the Hormuz closure alive, and forcing Washington to spend billions on military deployment?
To be really honest, I don't think anyone really knows, but I think one can go by perhaps people who know them a little better than, and by that I mean the Omani foreign minister. Mm-hmm. Badr al-Busaidi wrote a piece in The Economist this week in which he said some very startling things. For example, he said that we must, as friends of America, get America back in control of its own foreign policy. He obviously was hurt from the fact that he was mediating the talks between the U.S. and Iran there in Geneva, supposed to meet in Vienna, which fell apart. Oman is a country that has faced Iranian bombardment and Iranian threats. And yet the Omani foreign minister wrote that faced with the extinction or elimination of its regime, Iran has chosen to do what perhaps is the most rational thing, which is to threaten Gulf countries and particularly American bases there. But what Iran is saying is that the U.S. that put its bases down in these Gulf countries as a deterrent, because the fear was even then was Iran, that kind of guarantee of security no longer exists.
Do you think that the U.S. fundamentally it underestimated Iran, its military capabilities, also its resilience, so to say?
I think where they have misunderstood or miscalculated is the culture and the idea that people in Iran would not necessarily come out against their regime. I think that was a real expectation in the U.S. that having seen the protests just in January this year and the widespread the amount of protesters who were killed or injured during those protests, there was some kind of a calculation that power would come out on the streets as soon as the regime was decapitated. I think that's one miscalculation. I think the second miscalculation was about what we were just discussing, this decentralization of power, the ability to keep striking and strike more and more powerful missiles, even though maybe they have bombed parts of Tehran, which they thought would not be able to oversee such launches. The third seems to have been a miscalculation based on what the US and Israel did last year when they bombed nuclear installations across Iran. And that is on the Strait of Hormuz. I think when Iran made that threat last year, and many of us had gamed it immediately, you know, what will this mean for the world if Iran goes through on its threat to totally block off the Strait of Hormuz? I think the U.S. possibly felt that that was a false threat, that Iran would never go through with it because of the huge cost it would have, not just on other countries and friends of Iran, but the huge cost it would have on Iran itself.
I also want to talk to you about, since you mentioned the Israeli strikes, journalists always being on the line of fire. If you saw RT correspondent Steve Sweeney, there was a missile attack like right next to him. We've also seen several journalists in Palestine killed by Israeli strikes. Even war has some rules. Do you think that this has gone a step ahead?
We've had non-state actors targeting, kidnapping journalists, what ISIS did to journalists, what others have done to journalists all the time. We have seldom seen this kind of targeting of journalists as we saw in Gaza. I think the Committee to Protect Journalists actually put out a statistic, which was to the extent that the number of journalists killed in Gaza was more than all the other journalists targeted combined in a certain period.
Which is crazy.
But it also points to a pattern. Now, on the Israeli side, their response and their defense has always been that those journalists were, in a sense, actually also terrorists. That now has been broadened. So anyone who is reporting and putting out a message that you think is on behalf of somebody else is now a legitimate target. I know that there has been some amount of explanation that the attack on your colleague was perhaps an attack in the region. It was near him. It wasn't directly on him. But one can't take away the idea that journalists are now being threatened like this. Because in the old days, if you saw a journalist in the field, then a state would normally protect them. They would not continue to target that area.
Do you think that the Strait of Hormuz was ultimately the card that changed everything? If it did, Suhasini, is that what brought Washington back to the negotiating table again, if the negotiations are on again?
It made the point that you needed to think about this problem differently, because it wasn't just now Gulf countries that were saying our bases, U.S. bases are being targeted, as a result of which we are being targeted, as a result of which our energy installations have come under fire. It was now the rest of the world, and it was being affected in a way that didn't put the U.S. and Israel in great light. Nobody was saying it was just Iran's fault. Mm-hmm. People were now pointing to the U.S. and Israel and saying that this had been threatened, so find a way out of this.
And how long do you think, Suhasini, India can sustain itself if the Strait of Hormuz remains choked?
I think if it remains choked, India will face restrictions. But the Iranian leadership and Prime Minister Modi have been in touch, and External Affairs Minister Jaishankar and Mr. Araghchi have been in close touch. I think it's very clear that the pain points for India are something Iran is willing to do something about. It's obviously not as much, perhaps, as some other countries. We've seen Iran allow Chinese ships. We've seen Iran allow Japanese ships. We heard the ambassador to Sri Lanka yesterday say not just Sri Lankan ships, but if Sri Lanka needs supplies, we will supply them, which is actually quite interesting for a country which is at war right now to say. With India, it has been a little bit more piecemeal. When Prime Minister Modi called the first time, and that was the first time during the war, spoke to President Pezeshkian. After that, we saw two ships come through. After his last call, just a few days ago, we've seen another two ships have come through. Indian officials feel quite confident that the other ships also will be given clearance to come.
Mm-hmm.
But clearance is not the same. And I say this, Ranjan, because as the war progresses, the sort of risks to ships in the Hormuz is actually growing.
India has deep cultural, historic ties with Iran. On the other hand, Mr. Modi visited Israel just before the war. His remarks referring to Israel as fatherland were criticized by some. Where does India's foreign policy stand when it comes to this war?
I have to say Prime Minister Modi was quoted out of context when he spoke about the fatherland and motherland, because if you go back to the speech, he's talking about Indians who took Aliyah. So Indians of Jewish origin who moved to Israel see Israel as the fatherland, but India as the motherland. It was also part of a larger speech, which was seen as very, very controversial from the point of view that Prime Minister Modi was saying what, you know, has never been India's policy to firmly align with a country. India has kept a strategic autonomy in all these situations. And for Prime Minister Modi in that speech at the Knesset to say that we stand shoulder to shoulder with Israel in the moment and beyond seemed like he was making a strategic point, not just a humanitarian point. So Prime Minister Modi's visit to Israel in the midst of what was clearly an incoming war was a shift in policy. There's no question about that. The kind of statements he made while he was there and the fact that Mr. Netanyahu, before he came, said India would be part of what he called a hexagonal alliance, really like a star that would take on the rest, take on Iran and these other countries. To me, that itself was a shift from India's normal position. India's position with West Asia, It's a region that is always at war with itself. There's so many countries that are fighting each other, whether it's Qatar and the UAE, whether it is Saudis and Iran, Israel and Iran, all the rest. It is the policy has always been balanced bilateral relations with all countries there. Mm. Good relations, historical relations. We've been trading for hundreds of years with these countries. And then at the beginning of the war, the position of New Delhi that only criticized Iranian strikes, that was again, it seemed like there was a lengthening of that shift. But I think halfway through this war, there's been a shift back to the center. If you see Prime Minister Modi's speech in the Lok Sabha, and I urge your viewers to go and read it, it is a very, very statesmanlike speech that he made, you know, where he speaks again about India's precepts, dialogue and diplomacy. There is no point in this kind of war. This is not going to lead anywhere. India has been in touch with all players in West Asia. And he makes that point without any rancor, without any bias, showing not a preference for one over the other.
Let me bring in Moscow here, Suhasini. So Russia's energy self-sufficiency, do you think that's the main reason why Russia takes these bold geopolitical decisions? Because at the center of this war and mostly everything that we're seeing in the region is oil, is energy.
Well, I do think that Russia, too, has allowed Iran to fight this war. We're not seeing, you know, Russian military coming to Iran's rescue. And in the UN as well, where one had expected Russia may have pushed for a resolution different from the one we saw, which 130 countries signed on to, which only criticized Iran for its attacks on the Gulf, that Russia and China would use their vetoes rather than abstaining. I think that's because Russia and perhaps China as well have decided that in this, there are many threads. There are many different relationships that they are all balancing at this time and therefore have not perhaps exerted themselves in the same way. When it comes to energy, I think this decision was made years ago. In 2014, after the Russian invasion of Crimea and the annexation of Crimea, we saw very clearly the move from both Moscow and from Beijing was to build that $400 billion pipeline between them. That was even before they had built this No Limits partnership. It was the understanding that Western sanctions will target this. What, if you ask me is perhaps going to change the calculations a little bit is what the U.S. has done. After all, the U.S. didn't take Europe into account when it decided to lift the sanctions, they say temporarily, on Russian oil. So countries like India, for example, which is a huge area of demand, and others are now buying Russian oil. The question is, at what point will the U.S. put those sanctions back on? Because we know from India's behavior that New Delhi for 3 years refused to cut Russian oil. They didn't do it during the entire Biden administration because the sanctions were coming more or less from Europe, and India was able to withstand those. But when the U.S. put that extra 25% tariff and then followed it up with more stringent sanctions, shutting down of all the money flows for India to pay for Russian oil, we saw India begin to reduce its intake of Russian oil. And other countries have also done that. So can a country of India's stature, and I say this not just for India, but also so many other countries that are watching India and taking cues from India's foreign policy, can a country of India's stature be played like a puppet on all of this? And I think when you asked your question about Moscow, I think Russia is realizing they actually have to do very little. They have to be seen doing very little even in this, because the U.S. is itself dismantling some of the threats that it had put out.
President Putin has called Iran a loyal friend, a reliable partner. But do you think that this friendship is more about having a common enemy, that big bully that keeps putting sanctions left, right and center?
You know, over the last few decades, what we have seen is a certain construct, and there's no question that America did dominate the world, especially after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Contrary to that, counter to that, there was a different kind of movement, a non-Western structure. Mm-hmm. So after the 1990s, if you see in 2000s, you saw the growth of the SCO, you saw the growth of BRICS. You saw the growth of a non-Western world, if you like, coming back. And obviously Russia and China, as the founders of the SCO, were a big part of that construct. Now, if you come from there into this idea of why there's a Russia-Iran equation, I think it's very clear this is an area of safety for them. If you look at the connectivity plans that they had through Bandar Abbas, International North-South Transport Corridor, if you saw Prime Minister Modi's, for example, visit to Moscow,
yeah,
2 years ago, the push for business and connectivity and trade, energy also, but all of those really made up what could be a non-Western construct. So I think that is where you see a lot. There is, of course, a lot more to the Russia-Iran relationship. There's a lot more to the growing Iran-China relationship that even India has seen with some concern. But I think the underpinnings of it is this kind of idea that the world is coalescing into a kind of global construct which is divided.
And this new order, the multipolar world, the emergence of it, also the emergence of multilateral institutions like the BRICS, for example. Do you think the war in West Asia could weaken some of these institutions?
As institutions, perhaps. The idea behind those institutions remains. I mean, you see, today India is in this position because it is unable to get a statement at BRICS. But at the end of the day, if there was some kind of a BRICS summit, as India is hoping to host, just think of who all will come together in it. There's Russia, there's China, there's Egypt, there's Ethiopia, there's UAE, there's Iran. There's Indonesia. So you're touching different parts of this non-Western construct. It is a powerful idea. So yes, BRICS is in trouble today, we might say. SCO was able to put out a statement, BRICS was not. But I don't think that those philosophies that underpin these groupings are going away. I will make the point that I think when you ask about which institutions are going away, there's no question that the United Nations has never been so weak. I mean, to have no voice, forget having a voice on one side or the other, but to have literally no voice in this particular conflict shows how weak the UN has become.
India's connectivity ambitions, the Chabahar port in Iran, India has spent millions of dollars in that. With what's happening in West Asia, do you think this is the death of Chabahar port?
I think that is with New Delhi to decide. I think it isn't necessarily over. But the dream that India had projected in 2016, when Prime Minister Modi went to Tehran, stood with the Iranian and Afghan president, that dream has taken a very big hit. In April this year, so not just a month away, the U.S.'s extra waiver of sanctions on India for Chabahar will come to an end. So there are three ways out. The U.S. may extend that waiver. Or the U.S. may say, no, this is it, and India complies. The third option is the U.S. refuses to extend its sanctions and that India says, well, we are going to go ahead with them, or that we will not accept the U.S.'s sanctions. Because as I said, there is this now, you know, list of areas where the U.S. has told India, we will put sanctions on you unless, and India has given in, and it has not been to India's benefit.
Moscow and Beijing, they've been long-term allies of Iran. A friend in need is a friend indeed, they say. But did they help Iran enough?
There are reports that Chinese armaments did reach Iran just before the war. There are reports that Russia continues to help with intelligence in terms of where Iran's missiles and drone attacks should be pointed. And that China also helps with that. There are reports that Russia and China certainly have, not necessarily condemning and pressuring Iran to open up the Hormuz Straits, have given Iran a little bit of leeway to allowing it to do that. So in those respects, perhaps, they have helped. But at the end of the day, what seems very clear is that if the conflict is maintained at this level, which is American strikes on certain Iranian military installations, a few energy installations, then it is Iran that is countering them, not any of the others.
Countries like China, they have built over time this unimaginable energy independence, so to say. What about India? It's, of course, dependent on imports, but is it a policy gap? Is it just geography, or is it the reality of developing countries?
We keep putting a lot of our attention to energy security, but it's three. It's the food, it's the fuel, it's the fertilizer security. All of those are critical for India. And I think what has emerged in this war should have emerged with the Israeli bombardment of Gaza and the going away of connectivity projects like IMEC, that India is going to have to find not just diversity, not just diversify where we get our energy from or where we get our food and fuel from, but also to look much closer. Because these choke points are now becoming realities. Today, Hormuz is a reality. The Suez has been a reality after the Houthi strikes. Tomorrow, Malacca could be a reality. So if these are going to be your choke points, you have to start looking for both markets as well as for sources of your supplies much closer.
You see, South Asia has built its entire energy strategy around Gulf contacts. Do you think it's time that India now take the lead for South Asia and rethink energy powered by renewables?
Oh, I think the fact is that since Mr. Trump came to power the first time, Trump 1.0, the U.S.'s walkout from, the Paris Accords kind of took the timetable off the rails. So if countries that were growing and were emerging had started to look very seriously at renewables, it was also because the U.S. was a partner in there. The U.S. had promised. I mean, the U.S. had promised, $100 billion to the emerging countries during the Paris Accords. But Mr. Trump just canceled all of that. So all those countries that were looking towards a renewable transition with the hope of then falling in line with the carbon zero goals that the Western world or the developed world was really putting on us. It was because we thought this funding was coming. Okay, so the funding didn't come. And then, 4 years of Trump, after which the Biden administration tried to put those back into place, but it was clear the money was not coming. So countries had to start looking much more at their own resources and doing renewable transitions, which was much smaller. India, even Pakistan, for example, had this big gas crisis and then moved to much smaller solar panels around the countries. But all of those have got caught in the supply chain resilience problems. China one day decides to stop sending India chips or, you know, the batteries required for solar panels. And then what does India do? So I think, yes, there's no question that we have to start looking at reliance, self-reliance in renewables all over again.
When the dust of the war settles down, in your opinion, will West Asia be weaker or will it be more resilient? Will it be more stronger?
I, you know, we have not yet got to the point where we can truly say the day after. What is going to happen on the day after this war is over? Because in some ways, you can say some parts of this war began in 2023. I mean, the Israel-Palestine issue, of course, is 100 years old. But in 2023, what we saw as the attack on Israel, a kind of brutality by Hamas that we had not seen before, and then Israel's counterattacks and its complete bombardment of Gaza, the use of methods which really were against international law, the use of this targeted strikes, for example, in Iran. So, you know, sort of violating sovereignty, territorial integrity and all the rest to kill a leader of Hamas there, the attacks on Qatar. So we saw a kind of dislodging of the international order already starting from there. And now we have seen a complete obliteration, if you like, of any idea of what the rules are. The US has been part of this. The world's largest superpower that actually underpinned the international order is today its violator. When the leader of that country says that we bombed a ship in the Indian Ocean for fun, you start to wonder what is going to remain. Former Foreign Secretary said that Humpty Dumpty has fallen off the wall. You can't put it back together again. So I think already we should be thinking about what is that new world order going to be? What happens the day after all of this settles? As you said, whether it's dust or rubble that is settling, you know, what are going to be the new rules that people go by?
Suhasini Heather, diplomatic editor at The Hindu, many thanks for your time.
Thank you, Ranjan, and thank you to RT for inviting me.
Pleasure.